From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rise and fall of the Hollywood studio system. Film historian Thomas Schatz has written a new book about how the studios developed their distinctive styles and how movie making has changed since the studio system collapsed. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews a movie he considers one of Hollywood's greatest triumphs, Lawrence of Arabia. A restored version of this 1962 classic has been released, featuring several scenes cut from the original. Rock critic Ken Tucker returns with the Tucker Top 5, and Roger Black shares his impressions of what a reader-friendly magazine should look like. Black is one of America's leading magazine designers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In 1938, that became the musical signature that preceded all 20th century Fox movies. In the classic era of Hollywood films, the signature of each studio extended far beyond the opening logo. My guest Thomas Schatz has written a new book about the distinctive movie-making styles of the studios, focusing on MGM, Warner Brothers, and Universal. He looks at the 1920s to the 1950s, when the studios wielded nearly absolute power over the film industry. They produced and distributed movies and even ran their own theater chains. Each studio had its own repertoire of contract stars, story formulas, production techniques, and marketing styles. And each was ruled by strong-willed and opinionated executives who Schatz describes as the most misunderstood and undervalued figures in American film history. Thomas Schatz is the director of graduate studies in radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas in Austin. He also writes for several film magazines and lectures at the American Film Institute. His new book is titled The Genius of the System. I asked Schatz why he's studying the days of the Hollywood studio system.
Well, it has something to do, I suppose, with my impression of the contemporary film industry, which is in, it strikes me, utter disarray, and also with the persistent appeal of those old movies. Obviously, it's beyond just the fact that I write and teach about film. It's trying to make sense out of how that system worked and how it was in fact a system, and the more closely I look at it, the more I come to understand that this really delicate balance kind of business and artistic interests really worked the way that system was structured. And it's also a matter, I suppose, of trying to make sense out of whether or not when I first got interested in studying film and writing about film, film criticism was really dominated by what folks call the auteur theory, which is the notion that the director is the author of the film. And the more I learned about Hollywood, particularly the old Hollywood studio system, the less sense that made to me. And I really was interested in trying to really dig into that, into the records, et cetera, of that era, and try to make sense out of how it did work and how important not only the director was, but the star, the screenwriter, the composer, the producer, the studio executive, and so on.
Describe what a studio is. A studio is really a whole self-contained world.
That's right. Anywhere from a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand employees, literally a physically self-contained environment with not only all those sound stages, anywhere from a half a dozen to say 20 sound stages, but also a back lot for shooting exteriors, and construction, literally barbershops, everything from barbershops and milliners to large plants where sets are constructed. These were environments where a virtual world could be created, in the span of a couple of months, and if we stop for a minute and think about what's involved in that, and the fact that anywhere from 6 to 10 films were in production at the same time on these various sound stages, that literally these narrative universes were being created and taken apart, week in and week out.
You suggest that each of the Hollywood studios had their own house style.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important? Why does that matter, that they each had their own style?
Well, for one thing, it was a matter of distinguishing their product from their competitors. And, you know, whether we're aware of it or not, I think when we're watching, you know, an old Jimmy Cagney gangster film, we know at some level that we're watching a Warner Brothers film. Or when we're watching, you know, an Andy Hardy movie, we know it's an MGM film. And we're watching an old horror film with Boris Karloff, that we're watching a Universal picture. At some level, that's registering, and at some level, I think we're very much aware of, you know, the fact that certain companies turned out a certain product. It's also worth keeping in mind that in the old days, they had regulated patterns of distribution and exhibition. That you knew that if you went to a certain theater, in the old days, the Orpheum or the Paramount or the State Theater, that you were going to see a film with certain stars, probably with certain genres that were cranked out by a certain company.
If Warner Brothers was more associated with gangster films and Busby Berkeley musicals,
mm-hmm.
and MGM with a certain kind of screwball comedy, and later with Fred Astaire musicals, and Universal with horror movies like The Mummy and Frankenstein, Dracula,
mm-hmm.
did these styles come out of marketing decisions or out of the sensibilities of the people who work there? Was it a combination of the two?
Definitely a combination of the personalities, quite literally, primarily I think of the studio executives as much as the top talent, and also without question pretty basic marketing decisions. Universal, you know, with its European distribution system, a heavy emphasis on Germany, knew that its horror films would play well in Germany. Warner Brothers was a company that owned very few what they would then have called prestige or first run theaters. And it knew its pictures. It was more of a working class studio. And it knew it. It knew that its clientele was what we would now say more blue collar. MGM and Paramount owned a large number of first class, first run, deluxe downtown theaters, and they turned out sophisticated comedies. They turned out much more sophisticated product. And that was very much as you know a marketing decision, you know, as well as a matter of and you know those marketing decisions were what were behind developing certain types of personnel at the studios.
Right, because I guess if you're doing gangster movies and if you had a kind of cast of characters on salary who were good for those movies, you had it made.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it's also worth pointing out that, you know, that MGM was not only into sophisticated comedy, but it was into, you know, love stories. It was a very wealthy studio that was into putting two or three stars. And the maybe best example from the 30s is Grand Hotel, which was one of the granddaddies of the all-star pictures, they used to call them. Whereas Warner Brothers very rarely put more than one of its stars in any picture. And we tend to associate individual stars with genres as a result. Betty Davis melodramas, Errol Flynn swashbucklers, Jimmy Cagney crime films, you know, Paul Muni biopics. That they didn't put their stars together because it was not efficient. And this was not a company that had the kind of money that MGM did in those days.
My guest is Thomas Schatz, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, The Genius of the System, which is about Hollywood filmmaking in the studio era. The balance of power within the Hollywood studios was really different than the balance of power in filmmaking today.
That's for sure.
First of all, there was the star system,
mm-hmm.
and the actors were really controlled by the studios. They were cast by the studios. They were groomed by the studios. And as you pointed out, there was a lot of typecasting, and therefore there was very little creative freedom for the actors. Now, Betty Davis is someone you describe as having gotten around the system.
Right.
What was the problem she was having, and how did she get around it?
Well, Betty Davis worked at Warner Brothers, which in the 1930s was very much dominated by male stars, Jimmy Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, Paul Muni, etc., and male-oriented story formulas, gangster pictures, and so on, biopics, swashbucklers. And Betty Davis was being cast time and again in crime films. She did make an occasional melodrama, but there was a woman named Kay Francis who was at the studio that got most of those parts. And Davis really felt that there was more that she could do, and she wasn't getting the opportunity to do it. Things got interesting when the only loan out of Davis's career during the 1930s, and we're talking about literally dozens and dozens of films, was to RKO in 1934 to do a film called Of Human Bondage. And it was really the first time that what we would think of, she played the Cockney prostitute, this kind of emasculating bitch. And the kind of role that we tend to associate with Betty Davis, this was the first chance she really had to display that personality. And it was a huge hit, and it got Warner's thinking a little bit differently about what she might be able to do, but not differently enough. She wound up doing a film called Dangerous, which won her an Academy Award and literally went on strike. It did not work for a year. And went to Europe and wound up in court with Jack Warner.
She was refusing to make movies that she didn't want to
make.
Yeah,
which in those days was tough because the way the contract system worked, if you were suspended, she just basically took a suspension. You couldn't sit out your contract. She had a 7-year contract. And while you were suspended, they would just tack that time on to the duration of the contract. So basically she knew that it wasn't a matter of just sitting out the contract, but waiting out Jack Warner, knowing that she'd never get out of that contract. And eventually Jack Warner, after a long court battle, which Warner's won, to try to keep her, basically to keep her from working for another company, Jack Warner did finally buy the rights to Jezebel, which she'd been bugging him for 2 years to do, since he wouldn't let her play Scarlett O'Hara. He'd made that real clear. He wouldn't loan her to David Selznick for Gone with the Wind. But he did buy Jezebel, which allowed her to play this Southern aristocratic bitch. And it was a fabulous role, won an Academy Award, and really did set her off into that string of fabulous movies of the next couple of years, Dark Victory, now Voyager, The Letter, etc. Great movies.
Katharine Hepburn was another actress who was having a problem within the studio system.
You bet. Katharine Hepburn did kind of the same thing. She won a couple of Academy Awards very early. She was had a couple of nominations and actually did win one early. In 1938, she was basically was voted by the major exhibitors of the United States as being box office poison. There was a list they had every year of stars who they thought were overrated and could not pull their weight at the box office. And the studio let her know that they were not going to be giving her the same kind of important roles. This was RKO, and she bolted. She basically went back to New York, said, I'm not going to work in pictures anymore. She went back and did a Philip Barry play, Philadelphia Story. And in lieu of a salary, she took the screen rights. She basically had Barry give her the screen rights to the play. And when the play was a hit, she went back to Hollywood, went to Louis B. Mayer at MGM, and basically packaged the project. Said, I want, I'll give you the screen rights for $250,000. I want George Cukor to direct. I want Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart to co-star. And that film, of course, was a huge hit. And it really did initiate a long tenure of Hepburn's at MGM, and it was Hepburn, as a matter of fact, who, as a follow-up to that, suggested that they do Woman of the Year with Tracy. She'd never met Tracy before. She was the one that basically told Mayer that if she was going to do another film, she wanted to co-star with Tracy. And she, without question, had more power than anyone at that studio during the 1940s. And basically, it was a matter of her leaving Hollywood and coming back on her own terms. And it's important to note, in both Davis and Hepburn's case, that the system wasn't totally inflexible. And these stories aren't that isolated. You know, we could look at the careers of people like Bogart. There are a number of other people who really went through a period of not having much control over their career and eventually got it.
Yeah, but for the most part, the actors were owned and groomed and controlled.
Right, that's
right.
By
the studio. Now, in looking at how the roles of different people who make movies have changed over the years, you say that the production executives have been the most misunderstood and undervalued figures in film history.
Right.
And you're referring, again, back to the days of the Hollywood studio system. How did the role of producer compare? I mean, what did a producer do then that's different from what a producer does now?
Well, one real important distinction is that there was a hierarchy of authority at these studios. There was literally a higher echelon of people with a lot of power that went from the studio boss to the production chief to producers who produced individual films. And if anyone really controlled the process of production, it was the production chief. It was Thalberg at MGM. It was Zanuck when he was at Warner Brothers. These were individuals who basically coordinated the entire production process, but they also assigned individual producers to supervise the films, who were basically their assistants. And these were the guys who took a film from conception literally through release, and who were involved in budgeting the entire year's schedule. And, you know, we tend to, and we shouldn't undervalue the director. The director is extremely important, but a film would go through lengthy pre-production supervised by the production executive, the production chief, before the director had any involvement at all, and it would go through elaborate post-production editing, retakes, previews, and basically we have an individual at these studios who kept track of the entire program of pictures, who took individual pictures from conception all the way through release, and who really did in effect orchestrate the entire process. It was a real efficient way to make movies. These days, you know, we're in a situation where the director has gotten a lot more authority. Most directors are really what we would call hyphenates. They're producer directors. They play the role that a supervisor in the old system would have played in terms of taking a project from conception through release. But there isn't the support structure of a studio anymore. There isn't the kind of productivity and the kind of contract personnel, both above and below the line, as they say in the business. You know, a lot of cinematographers and set designers, as well as actors and writers. There isn't the same kind of structure, and it was really you know, the efficiency of the people that orchestrated that structure that made the all system work as effectively as it did, I think.
Well, one thing the producer didn't have to do during the studio system is raise money, which is something that the producer spends a lot of time
doing now. Yeah, it's an excellent point. And we're looking at a period when, as they say in the business world, that the industry was vertically integrated, which meant that the most powerful studios, MGM, Warner Brothers, Paramount, etc., not only made movies, but they had their own distribution and exhibition chains. When I was a kid, for example, a young kid, was the studio system was just coming unraveled, I went to the State Theater, and that would have been a Lowe's MGM. I went to the Orpheum Theater, that would have been RKO. I went to the Paramount, which of course was a Paramount studio owned theater. The point here being that these were mainly what we would call palaces, those huge theaters. We can't even conceive of it these years, where a good sized theater is now 500 seats. These were theaters that had 1,000 to 5,000 seats in them, 80-foot screens. They cranked out an enormous amount of revenue, and they created the kind of cash flow that enabled these studios to keep cooking and to crank out a feature film a week, which is far, far beyond what any studio can turn out these years.
I want to talk with you more about the days of the Hollywood studio system, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest, Thomas Schatz, is the author of the book The Genius of the System. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Thomas Schatz, and he's the director of graduate studies in radio, TV, film at the University of Texas in Austin. He also writes for many film magazines and lectures at the American Film Institute. His new book, The Genius of the System, is about how the studio system operated in the classic Hollywood era. You were just telling us about how the studios also owned the theaters that they screened the movies at, and that was challenged in, I think it was the late 1940s. Who actually accuse them of having a monopoly or an oligopoly, whichever it was.
Actually, the challenge initially came in the late 1930s. Without getting into a whole lot of detail, Roosevelt came in, National Recovery Administration, all that business. They basically gave a number of industries in the United States, including the film industry, not quite carte blanche, but they allowed industries to develop overtly monopolistic practices simply to survive the Depression. And so basically the integrated system of production, distribution, exhibition was okayed by the government, and it was allowed up to a point. As the economy began to recover in the late 1930s, the government began to kind of reconsider these monopoly practices. But what happened in the movie industry was theater owners that wanted to develop big theaters in the cities realized that those markets were controlled and really tied up by the major studios. So it was the theater owners that initially encouraged the Justice Department to go after the integrated majors, and this is a court case that what we now call the Paramount Decree, because Paramount was the first studio named in the suit, was basically it was adjudicated finally in May 48, but actually was initiated in late 1938. It took them 10 years to work it out, and basically the studios were able to fend off the government for 10 years, and the outcome of that suit basically was that the studios would have to siphon off their theater holdings. And every movie would have to be, you know, produced on a unit-by-unit basis and sold that way. And every theater out there in the world would have to have an equal shot at any film that was produced.
Was that responsible for the collapse of the studio system?
It was sure a key issue. I mean, there are so many things that happened.
What else happened?
Well, this gets very complicated. The rise of the unions and the guilds gave individuals more power, and individuals, particularly what we call in the industry above the line individuals, and these are the top talent, writers, directors, producers, stars, composers. It gave them more talent individually. It gave them more leverage than the system, and it made the production process more complicated because they did have the ability to. I mean, you got five or six people telling you how a film has to be made if they're going to work on it. It creates problems. What also happened, and this is a complicated deal, but it's extremely important, and is the changing tax laws that basically to finance the defense buildup in World War II, and this is worth going into, it's a remarkable statistic, the 80% tax bracket dropped from $5 million annual income to $200,000. So that basically people who were making $200,000 were taking home only a very small fraction, 10 to 20% of their income, if it was a salary. And capital gains tax, if you started a company, an independent company of your own, and risked your income as literally as a venture, you could avoid, you could be taxed at only 25%. So you had a lot of top talent, not just stars, but also directors and producers, looking to start their own independent companies. This is before the Paramount decree. So one of the things that's happening is individual power is becoming more and more of an issue. Now, what also happens, obviously, after World War II is that, you know, two important things are television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, network television comes along. And commercial TV emerges literally from 45 to 48. And it clearly is threatening to displace the movies. I mean, people now watch TV the way we used to go to the movies as a kind of primary means of narrative screen entertainment. And what's also happening after the war is massive changes in American lifestyles, the baby boom, suburbanization, families literally in an unprecedented, you know, in unbelievable numbers are being not only generated, but they're being generated away from the inner cities, the way away from the urban centers where the biggest theaters were. And if we just think about what was going on in the late 40s, early 50s, perhaps in our own lives and our parents' lives, what that's doing is it's moving, you know, the primary market away from the theaters, and this is the birth of the drive-in. I mean, all kinds of things in the ultimately suburban theaters, multiplex theaters, and shopping malls. We're seeing a you know, this along with the Paramount decree is really literally disintegrating the old system.
Well, the studios basically became financing and distribution companies,
right,
after the collapse of the studio system. What do you think we lost when the studios collapsed?
Okay, we lost. Actually, it's worth pointing out that the very folks that screamed loudest about the old system, the theater owners, are the ones that suffered the most. Because what happened was, when the studios no longer had an integrated system, they lost their cash flow, and they lost when they no longer had their own system of distribution, exhibition. They didn't have those revenues constantly coming in from the theaters to pay overhead at the studio. So what happened initially was all those contract personnel were fired. And in a span of, you know, from, you know, 48 to 55, the old studio system literally, I mean, in terms of all those contract personnel, those literally hundreds to thousands of people that worked for each of the studios were let go. And the whole nature of employment in the film business changed. And that, obviously, we lost the kind of continuity and efficiency of that old system. And the theater owners, we were no longer cranking out movies at the same rate, and the theater owners didn't have product. Not only that, but there was a tendency to bet more on individual films. Every film became an independent business venture, and we see the beginning of what we now call the blockbuster syndrome,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is bet the ranch on individual films. And, you know, in the old days when 80% of the films released made money, I mean, that was no longer possible, literally. And now it was a matter of, you know, you just hope every fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth movie release does excellent business and makes up, you know, for the losses on your other pictures. So that kind of mentality, that kind of winner-take-all blockbuster mentality has become more and more prevalent. You know, I also think we lost the kind of continuity that came from, you know, when we think of the old studio system, we do tend to think of these star genre formulations. We tend to think of a star and associate him or her with a whole series of pictures. And what made that work was not just the studio system, but it was these production units that emerged at every studio. The fact that the same personnel worked on one Betty Davis melodrama after another, or worked on one, you know, Humphrey Bogart crime thriller after another, or worked on, you know, whatever it would be. And that, you know, the Freed unit at MGM cranking out all those musicals, those great Gene Kelly, Judy Garland musicals, that the stability of the studios in general allowed those units to flourish, and they allowed these collaborative groups to work together. And I don't think there's much question, but that, you know, the consistency in terms of quality was something that we've never seen anything remotely similar to since.
Well, you could say that Francis Coppola's Zoetrope Studio and George Lucas's Lucasfilms were attempts to recreate a smaller version of the studio
right.
system. What did they show?
Well,
what do you think of the results looking back now?
Yeah, and I don't think the impulse will ever go away to recreate the studio system. But without that kind of overarching integration that held the business at large together, it's not going to work. What also is a real problem, and we should think of Robert Altman, the guy that made MASH and a lot of really great movies, but he started a thing called Lionsgate, that there were a number of efforts in the 70s and 80s to recreate the studio system. You know, part of the problem was, particularly with Coppola and Altman, is that these guys were not businessmen. They were not producers. And the people that have really succeeded And Lucas is the best example. The people that have really succeeded in recreating at least a sense of a studio environment are individuals who really are at heart producers, not directors, not writers, not, and they literally don't think of themselves in art, as artists the same way that, without question, Coppola has thought of himself over the years. And that, but again, without this kind of regulated output and without a marketplace that's more stable, there's no way you can dependably crank out a lot of pictures with the hope of selling them and of them doing well. The closest thing right now actually is at Walt Disney. A guy named Michael Eisner is running that studio, and he too is trying to get back to, and I think they may be pulling it off more effectively than anyone has in the last 40 years, you know, really getting back to a kind of regulated output. They're up to, they claim, you know, 25 to 30 pictures a year now, and I think they can do it. And the pictures are doing quite well, and it's a matter largely, I think, of Eisner understanding, you know, how to put a certain amount of continuity and efficiency into that system.
Do you think that there are any strengths of working without studios now? One I could maybe think of is that it's possible for small films, small personal films that don't belong to any studio to get made. And I'm thinking, I guess, of some of the films, and I don't know if you'd consider this to be like a studio, that are funded by Channel 4, you know, like
sure.
A Beautiful Laundrette, Mona Lisa.
Right.
Pretty cheap films that are very interesting, very idiosyncratic.
Right, and that is something that the studio system could not have produced. On the one hand, the studio system was responsible for some real interesting innovation and experimentation, but there were certain limits that were put on creativity and inventiveness in that old era, and there wasn't room for personal filmmaking. You even with a film like Citizen Kane or say a John Ford Western or something, we there's no way that an individual in that old system could have the kind of creative control over the entire product, the production of an individual film, the way that an individual can now. And so you get more quirky films now, you get more personal films, you get more idiosyncratic product. The scale's a little bit nuts, though. I mean, the opportunities for individual filmmakers to break in, or the opportunity of a film that's made for only, quote-unquote, say, $1 to $5 million, actually doing any business is pretty remote unless you've got someone like Channel 4 behind you, unless you've got an outlet for product guaranteed on the way in.
One last question. When you're looking at a classic Hollywood film now,
mm-hmm.
with your awareness of the studio system, does it affect how you see that movie, what you look for in that movie, what you think about when you watch it?
Well, no. I really think a good movie, I'd like to think at least, that even with the occupational hazard of you know, writing about and teaching about films and all that business, you know, a good movie still captures my imagination, and I'd like to think that I'll never lose the capacity to get taken up, to get lost in a movie, in a good movie, especially on first viewing. Now, the stuff that I've you know, taught and written about are films that I've looked at, you know, occupational hazard wise, again, you know, dozens, if not more than dozens of times, and there's something about a good film, obviously, that especially as I said on first viewing, that will capture you, and you give yourself to it, and you lose your sense of time, and you lose your distance, your kind of critical distance. And, you know, it's worth suggesting, too, that you know, the old, in terms of the way movies work, that hasn't changed very much. The kind of things that people really like about movies, the, you know, the kind of classical design of the films hasn't changed as much as the business has changed. And it's the nice thing about that old business is that it cranked out a lot of movies. And the things about movies that tend to work and to capture audiences hasn't changed all that much. So whether it's an old movie or a new movie, you know, the success of these cable channels that are, you know, recirculating these old movies is a real good indication that there's still something about them that appeals to viewers, that our sense of time is suspended when we're watching a good movie.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thomas Schatz is the author of The Genius of the System, published by Pantheon. Schatz writes about film for Premiere and Cineast magazines and teaches at the University of Texas in Austin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Washington Post investigative reporter Leon Dash. He lived for 17 months in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., while investigating the causes of the high rate of teenage pregnancy among the black urban poor. His controversial findings went against all the preconceptions he held when he began his research. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Roger Black is a publications designer who changed the look of Newsweek and the San Francisco Examiner, but he says there are limits to design. Coming up, Black tells us one magazine he wouldn't touch. Rock critic Ken Tucker returns with the Tucker Top 5. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new restored version of the 1962 classic Lawrence of Arabia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Senate Armed Services Committee was expected to approve the nomination of John Tower for Secretary of Defense today, but instead the vote was called off and not rescheduled. NPR's David Malpas has the story.
Committee Chairman Sam Nunn made the surprise announcement this morning, saying the committee file is not complete and that some members want an opportunity to review certain items that are in the file. John Warner, the ranking Republican on the committee, also disclosed that action on Tower was delayed because new information has come to light.
The chairman and I also have been looking at some additional information that's come to the attention of the two of us and therefore the committee as a whole. We feel it important to see that each one of these bits of information is carefully checked out, and the senator and I will be meeting with the FBI and others today.
Neither Warner nor Nunn would say where the additional information came from, what it was about, or whether it was serious. The White House today urged a prompt vote on Tower, but for now, a cloud remains over the nomination. I'm David Malpas at the Capitol.
The full Senate has given its approval to four other Bush administration nominees. In unanimous votes late today, the Senate confirmed former Representatives Jack Kemp to head the Department of Housing and Urban Development and Manuel Lujan as Secretary of the Interior. Michael Boskin also won approval as new chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, as did William Riley, who will head the Environmental Protection Agency. Jury selection continued today in the criminal trial of fired White House aide Oliver North. Another 50 potential jurors were sworn in and told to fill out a detailed questionnaire about their background and whether they had read, seen, or listened to North's testimony. Federal Judge Gerhard Gesell has selected only those people unfamiliar with North's congressional testimony because it was given under a grant of immunity and cannot be used against him in the criminal case. France said today it is not considering the release of a jailed Iranian terrorist who says his freedom was part of a deal France made with Iran to bring its hostages home. More from Lynn Terry.
The French Foreign Ministry today denied France had made a deal with Iran over the hostages. Five Frenchmen were released from Lebanon in 1987 and 88. However, a year before the first release, French President François Mitterrand did say he'd consider pardoning the terrorist, Anis Nakache, if all the hostages were released at the same time. But that didn't happen. Nakache is serving a life sentence for a 1980 assassination attempt against former Iranian Prime Minister Shapour Bakhtiar. A French woman and a policeman died in the attack. Last night, Nakache sent an appeal to Tehran, asking the government there to remind France of its commitment. The appeal coincides with a trip to Tehran on Sunday by the French foreign minister. The visit's the first by any French official to Iran in 10 years. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
South African President P.W. Botha stepped down today as head of the ruling National Party. Botha, who suffered a mild stroke last month, says he plans to stay on as head of the Pretoria government. Conservative Education Minister F.W. de Klerk was chosen to take Botha's place as party head, making it likely de Klerk will become South Africa's president when Botha's term expires in September. Israeli officials today backed away from the two-stage peace plan offered yesterday by Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. The troop withdrawal included in Shamir's plan has drawn sharp criticism from Israeli settlers in the occupied territories. They claim it will lead to a massacre of Jews. Stock prices were mixed today in heavy trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 4 points to close at 2333.75. Advances led declines 7-6 on volume of 183 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has determined that it is once again time for the Tucker Top 5, his survey of five new songs worthy of note.
All right, cats and kittens, you know how it works. We count down five songs, five hot platters which might otherwise get overlooked in this all-too-brief weekly segment. Beginning with number five, we have a song by Matthew Sweet. Rarely has a would-be pop star been so aptly named. Sweet's debut album 2 years ago was scandalously underrated, and on his second album, called Earth, he makes dreamy spaciness seem like a revelatory mood. His pretty, catchy music might remind you, if you were cynical, of Cat Stevens. But there's an edginess here that rescues Matthew Sweet from such a campy fate, a quality that renders a song like this one, called Easy, an irresistible pleasure. That's Matthew Sweet. Number four on this top five is Bunny Wailer's Botha the Mosquito. Bunny Wailer is the last living member of what many people think was the finest reggae band ever, Bob Marley and the Wailers. His new album is called Liberation, and the album jacket reprints all 30 articles of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Clearly, Bunny Wailer means business here, but he's not issuing a set of reggae position papers either. On Botha the Mosquito, he rails against South African apartheid with a dark sense of humor that deepens the song's message.
Hey, President Botha is the mosquito who annihilates Africa. President Botha, with the deadly bite, spreads the disease of apartheid. President Botha is the mosquito who annihilates Africa. Botha. It was Columbus, Gray, Hawkins, Raleigh, and Scott who established colonialism. This aspired Livingston, Rhodes, and Smith who brought about a subhuman regime. With the aid and support from Mr. Babylon, started the buying and selling of Africans. It became a marketplace for human cargo and the burial ground for the inhabitants, with men like Botha the mosquito who annihilate Africa.
It is also the purpose of this top five to warn you away from notable frauds and charlatans as a consumer service. With that in mind, I introduce you to the winners of this month's Most Cloying Album Award, bestowed upon The Violent Femmes. This highly praised, mostly insufferable band's new album is called Three, which is typically annoying since this is their fourth album. Here they show where they get it from on a song called Just Like My Father.
I'm just like my father, but I'm much worse. I'm just like my father, but I'm much worse. His mother, I hurt mine worse. I'm just like my brother, but I'm much worse. I'm just like my brother, but I'm much worse. He hurt his wife, I hurt mine first.
You You can feel the excitement building, I'm sure, as we reach number two on the Tucker Top 5. The song is Wild Thing by Tone Loc, and it's a hit on more substantial charts than my whimsical one. Wild Thing is number 5 with a bullet on the current Billboard pop chart and has sold over 1.4 million copies as a single, which is amazing when you consider that this song was initially released on a tiny independent label, Delicious Vinyl. If you're wondering whether this Wild Thing is a version of the Trogs' 1966 rock classic, I'd say it is, but it's a spooky echo of it, fractured and divided and shuffled around, so that while its melody barely remains, the anarchic spirit of that 20-year-old hit is all over this new one.
Working all week, 9 to 5 for my money. So when the weekend comes, I go get live with the honey. Rolling down the street, I saw this girl when she was pumping. I winked my eyes, got into the ride, went to a club with jumping. Introduced myself as Low, she said, you're a liar. I said, I got it going on, baby doll, and I'm on fire. Took her to the hotel, she said, you're the king. I said, be my queen, if you know what I mean, and let's do the wild thing. Wild.
Finally, the number one song on the Tucker Top 5, and it comes from a mighty unexpected source, Emmylou Harris. Harris has spent many years establishing herself as a polite, sensitive soul, but she finally loosens up on her new album, Bluebird. On this one, she gets back into the country rock that launched her career when she began recording with the late Graham Parsons. This is Heaven Only Knows.
I don't know who's right.
That's Emmylou Harris. Rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. If you read a lot of magazines, you're probably familiar with the work of my guest, Roger Black. He's a publications designer. He's been an art director at Rolling Stone, New York, and New West magazines. But he specializes in redesigning magazines and developing new typefaces. You can see an example of that work in the revamped Newsweek. An ongoing project of his has been the design of the new magazine, Smart. The first issue appeared last fall. Black says people are busier than they used to be, and the way they read magazines reflects that, and so should the design.
I think very few readers read a magazine all the way from the start to the finished. It used to be, I think, editors and writers thought that people would start in the upper left-hand corner and work their way through all the way through an article, no matter how many times it jumped and how little clue of what was inside was given to them. And now, now people really need to be encouraged to read a little bit more. And so you have to make the content a little more obvious.
So what are some of the general changes that this has resulted in the way magazines are designed now? For instance,
well, first of all, they're vastly more visual.
Mm-hmm.
Pictures are much more important than magazines than they ever were before. People putting out magazines now understand that a picture is a way to attract people's attention. You're much more likely to look at a picture first than even read a headline. And no one just grabs a story and sits down immediately and starts reading. Everybody pages through a magazine or a newspaper and sees what's inside. And so in order to attract people, all magazines have gotten livelier, more pictures, bigger pictures, more color. Even news magazines are all color now.
More white space also?
Well, it depends on the design. Some magazines like white space. I guess another thing you'd have to say is that they are designed. You took a magazine, a classic magazine like The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed once, 50 or 60 years ago, and that's enough. It's lasted until now. There are rumors that they're thinking about redesigning it now, which I think would be a big mistake.
I was thinking you might think it would be a good idea that you're so into new design that you might have been interested in redesigning it yourself.
No, that would be the last thing I'd ever want to do.
Why?
The New Yorker, for me, has always been a kind of a model of good magazine design. The cartoons, for example, are probably the best non-related visual elements breaking up a front of a magazine in use today. And it's an old idea. If people have tried to copy it, no one's really been able to do it as well because their cartoons aren't as funny. But the classic structure of magazines, the front of the book, the New Yorker Talk of the Town section, the feature section, followed by reviews and shorter items in the back, a back of the book, the critical material, was set up in the New Yorker years ago. And it's been imitated, but the New Yorker still does it really well. And I think that a magazine that is primarily interested in good writing, beyond having extremely legible and classic typography, they don't need art directors the way a different kind of magazine, say like Vanity Fair, might need.
One of the things you specialize in is redesigning magazines. You redesigned Newsweek. You redesigned recently the San Francisco Examiner. Let's talk about the changes that you designed for Newsweek, and I think this was back in 1985. A lot of our listeners will have seen the before and after. One of the things you did was change the logo.
Well, the logo was a mess. I mean, there are too many letters in the Newsweek logo. And, Time Inc. has always had wonderful names like Life and Time, which fit very nicely on the cover. Newsweek is a kind of a mess. I mean, there are, of course, I worked for Rolling Stone before that, and that's even a harder problem to solve. But one of the things is that you, in a weekly magazine that's responding quickly to current events, you have to be prepared for every possible kind of photograph or image on the cover, from very plain, simple backgrounds to very lively news pictures. And so the logo, the first thing as a kind of utilitarian thing was to make a logo that would read against anything. And so that created that red band behind the lettering. The other thing was to say, okay, let's fix it, and I always have it in the same place and in the same color, so it has a little bit stronger identity.
I think that some writers for magazines resent designers because they think that the designers are recommending more photos and shorter articles, more white space, and that results in shorter articles and the writers feel cheated.
Yeah, I think they do too. And in some cases, they are cheated. That's one reason I would resist any kind of heavy-handed art direction at The New Yorker. However, in a magazine like Newsweek, the whole name of the game is to boil down an enormous amount of information into a concise form. It's only 50 pages of editorial content, but it's in that they're trying to cover not only just a news summary, which is actually the least important thing that they do anymore, because so many other places you can get a better news summary faster. What they're trying to do is give you the meaning behind the news, the news analysis or what's going to happen next. And for it to be a useful thing as a news magazine, it has to happen. You have to be able to read it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you do is design typefaces. Now, to a layperson like me, I'd look at the books on typefaces and think, God, there's already like gazillions of different typefaces. Why would anybody need another one? But obviously, I guess there is a need for more. What is that need exactly, to design even more typefaces?
Well, there are more typefaces all the time, and it's a question of fashion or style. A friend of mine, Sumner Stone, who's really a great type designer who works out here in California, is always, when people ask him that, he says, "Well, it's like spoons. why do you always keep buying more spoons? how many spoons do you really need? And you look in your house, and there's dozens of different kinds of spoons. And a lot, some of them are for decoration, and some of them are for utility. Typefaces work that way, too. And the interesting thing is that it's such, there's such a personal and artistic and cultural mixture of things in a typeface that they respond to individual taste. So I find that they're really the basis of my work, and the most interesting thing that I work with every day. I was thinking that type is sort of going to be the sushi of the 90s. in the 1980s, you know, in the beginning, 10 years ago, sushi came in pretty strong and people started eating it. If you had suggested to any American in 1950 that he should eat raw fish, they would have thrown up. But now there's something happening because of desktop publishing and the fact that everybody's getting personal computers. With type, people are becoming aware of typefaces. People who never heard the word font now know what that means. And the little subtle differences between typefaces are becoming more and more obvious to the general public. And I think that's fantastic.
Do you think when the average reader is reading a page that they notice the type, or do you think it works on a more unconscious level?
Well, I think the text type is almost completely subliminal, and I think you want it that way. Anything that's distracting you from the words is not a good idea. But the headlines certainly carry a lot of style and flavor, and people are aware of that. And I think that any discerning reader is aware of good typography and good design in books or magazines. I think people have been all along. You look at books like those published by Alfred Knopf that have always been, you know, for 50 years, been very carefully done. And readers appreciate that. There's a certain rebellion to bad craftsmanship all over the place in modern society, and people would like to see things better made.
Have you seen the new Design of People magazine?
Yeah, I have, sure.
What do you think of it?
I think it's good. I think it wasn't particularly shocking or, you know, surprisingly different. I think it's a little more organized and, you know, better looking. Neither turn me off nor turn me on.
What about the new People page in Time magazine?
That I find idiotic. The particularly the tilted logo. It's like certain female members of the Reagan administration when they went out to parties. They were trying to look, you know, trying to have fun, and it looked like they never really knew how.
Okay, thank you again.
All right.
Roger Black heads his own firm, Roger Black Incorporated, based in New York and San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, what are you doing on the show today?
Well, Terry, we'll have the news from Washington about Secretary of Defense-designate John Towers' confirmation hearings and also about the latest maneuverings on a congressional pay raise. But we'll also be having a special report by Patricia Naimond about the Indonesian rainforest and trying to balance the concerns there of preserving the natural environment and also the economic development of the country. We'll also be hearing what's new in Kabul from Richard Weintraub of the Washington Post as the Afghans brace for the Soviet evacuation.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The definitive, newly restored version of the 1962 movie Lawrence of Arabia is being released this month in New York, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Like most film critics, I'm often asked, in tones ranging from the covetous to the condescending, why I ever got into this racket in the first place. And, like most film critics, I've offered up an array of windy responses. In fact, it's only rather recently that I realized that, however unimpressive, the truthful answer could be delivered in three little words. Lawrence of Arabia. I was probably 9 or 10 when I first saw it, not old enough to soak in all the history, not old enough to digest the implications of Lawrence's morality of pain and will, and certainly not old enough to extrapolate the great man's homosexuality from the glimmers and hints in Robert Bolt's screenplay. But I was old enough to know wonder, and to know that there was no magic quite like this magic, the feeling of being swept into a vast, distant, and intensely pleasurable world, and held there a happy hostage for hours. David Lean's movie is stuffy, traditional, and often too literal, and it is guilty, thank God, of the charge leveled at the time of its release, that it never clears up the mystery of who T.E. Lawrence was and what made him tick. How could it? And why should it? The sources of greatness are always mysterious, and the whys of Lawrence and his quixotic quest to unite the Arab tribes and lead them against the Turks have never entirely been fathomed. What one gets from the movie instead is a whiff of the ecstasy a button-down Brit experiences in the presence of all that space and of all the fire in the hearts of the men who inhabit it. One gets a little of that, for instance, in this scene, in which Peter O'Toole, as Lawrence, confronts a powerful Arab chieftain, magnificently played by Anthony Quinn.
My tribe is the Hawitat.
Work only for profit.
Work at Aldo's pleasure.
And Aldo's pleasure is to serve the Turks.
Serve? I serve?
It is the servant who takes money.
I am Aldo Butai. That Aldo serve! That Aldo Butai serve!
Part of what makes Peter O'Toole so spectacular is that we are watching a great actor invent himself by playing another great actor inventing himself. Lawrence used his Arab experience to create a persona along the lines of all his boys' book dreams. He was a boggling combination of intellectual rebel and greedy colonialist, of shrinking violet and power-crazed Nietzschean. And if Lean and Bolt haven't explained how that heady brew was concocted, O'Toole certainly shows us the sparks and bubbles it gives off. So much of this movie's resonance results from the collision of two notions of grandeur. We see the British Army in all its self-important pomp and hierarchy. And contrasted with that, we see the dunes and the light of Arabia, and the extraordinary sight of this burnished blonde glory hog in his white robes, slicing the air with his scimitar. In its own way, that contrast says far more than any book, or library of books, about the nature of colonialism, and indeed about intercultural relations of every stripe. This beautiful restoration doesn't change the movie much, but the interpolated bits and pieces make the storytelling smoother and more coherent, and the 70mm print you'll be seeing adds to its glory. Seeing Lawrence of Arabia now, I felt as awestruck as I had when I first saw it, years ago. Not because I was reliving my childhood, but because this movie still does what only a great movie epic can do. It makes the earth and its people seem wild and unknowable and limitless again. It turns the screen into a crucible for dreams.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Thomas Mader's parents were both therapists. As a child, he was always asked, "Do your parents analyze you?" Well, that was one of the many questions he asked 200 other people whose parents were therapists. On the next Fresh Air, Mader discusses his new book, Children of Psychiatrists and Other Psychotherapists. Also, critic Stuart Klawans reviews The Chinaman Pacific and Frisco Railroad Company. It's a new collection of short stories by Frank Chin. Stuart says Chin's stories infuse Chinese-American history with West Coast funk. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Mark Vogelzang, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.